Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome you to the inauguration of the 16th president of Michigan State University. Although it may have cut down on attendance, what could be more appropriate than this lovely, snowy Michigan winter day? As we approach this ceremony, the common sentiment among us is one of welcome, a feeling that we would like to reach out to the new president and say, "We're glad you're here." Some of us might even say, "Thank God you're here." It is appropriate that we have asked four members of the Presidential Search and Selection Advisory Committee to bring greetings for the groups they represented on the committee. Appropriate because the Presidential Search and Selection Committee, as the university community knows, was composed of two trustees, chairperson of the Academic Council Steering Committee, seven faculty, four students, one academic administrator, one non-academic employee, and an alumnus of the university. During the 15 months of the committee's existence, the members and the MSU board learned much from each other and learned much of the university and its constituent groups. In my opinion, what we all could agree upon was that we, trustees, students, faculty, staff, alumni, as well as constituent groups, such as farmers, business people, desired a leader for Michigan State University, someone to pull us together as a team so that MSU could continue to serve the people of the state and the nation in the land-grant tradition. We were searching for the inauguration, of course, not the coronation of a president. I therefore call upon Steve Spivey, graduate student in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, to bring greetings at this inauguration for the entire student body of the university. Mr. Spivey.
Thank you, Trustee Brough. Members of the platform party, ladies and gentlemen. Today, as we formally pass the torch to a new president at Michigan State University, undergraduate and graduate students alike join me in a warm and enthusiastic welcome to you, Dr. Mackey. To you is given the responsibility of leading Michigan State into the 1980s. As we enter a new decade, we trust that you will have the required courage and judgment, integrity, dedication, and humanity to meet the many challenges facing this university in the coming years. It is our hope that you will join all parts of the university to build on the land-grant tradition pioneered by MSU and enhance its reputation as a premier institution of higher education. As students, we are the principal beneficiaries of the university's many programs. We hope you will be ever mindful of our diverse concerns and the changing needs of a dynamic student body. President Mackey, we are confident you can meet the challenges of tomorrow, and we pledge our cooperation to work with you in the months and years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Next, I call upon William Caldwell of Midland, Michigan, who represents the many thousands of alumni of the university. I should tell you, however, that Bill, as well as ably representing the alumni on the Search and Selection Committee, was the wine steward of the committee. All-day meetings require food, and what is food without wine? Bill Caldwell.
Ladies and gentlemen, as the alumni representative of this great university, it is a pleasure to welcome the Mackey family to this institution, for it brings joy and excitement to all of us. To you, our new president, we, the alumni, and through our alumni association, we are enthusiastically and honored with your coming to Michigan State. We pledge our wholehearted support and cooperation, for we know that under your proven leadership, this university will continue to grow in prominence and stature. We look forward to many years of successful administration.
I now call upon Henry Dykema, Director of Financial Aids, who speaks for the staff of the university. Henry Dykema.
Chairman Brough, members of the Platform Party, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the non-academic personnel of the university, I extend to you, Dr. Mackey, our best wishes for a long and successful administration. We feel certain that under your leadership, this university will continue to grow in excellence and prestige. We, as an integral part of the university, pledge you our support in working toward that goal.
The fourth member of this group is Dr. Lester Manderscheid, Professor of Agricultural Economics and Chairperson of the Academic Council Steering Committee, who speaks for the faculty of the university. The faculty outnumbered the rest of the members of the committee. Their caucus could have outvoted the rest of us, but Les and his predecessor, Chairperson of the Academic Council Steering Committee, Gwen Norell, exercised that power very gently. Les Manderscheid.
Trustee Brough, ladies and gentlemen, the faculty extend a hearty welcome to our new colleague, Cecil Mackey. Inclusion of students, alumni, staff, trustees, and faculty on the Presidential Search and Selection Committee, as well as in today's platform party, symbolizes a joint effort necessary to move this university forward in the 1980s. A statement issued jointly by the American Council on Education, the American Association of University Professors, and the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges defines the president's role as, quote, "The president should be equally qualified to serve both as the executive officer of the governing board and as a chief academic officer of the institution and the faculty. This dual role requires that the president be able to interpret to board and faculty the educational views and concepts of institutional government of the other. The president should have the confidence of the board and the faculty. President Mackey, your faculty colleagues have confidence that you will succeed, and we look forward to working with you."
Michigan State University is a public university supported in large measure by tax dollars appropriated by the state legislature. We are especially honored this afternoon by the presence of Speaker of the House of Representatives, Bobby D. Krim, who brings greetings from the state government. Speaker Krim.
President Mackey. Distinguished members of the Platform Committee, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasant duty this afternoon to represent state government here, but first a sort of individual welcome to President Mackey. I happen to know that he is a confirmed jogger for about a quarter of a century, and we've talked about running together, and I look forward to doing some running with him out on the road. Having an additional person with me means my chance of survival and dodging the cars are much better, so I look forward to running with him. A clarification for the press, that was an attempt at humor. I would not like to... I would not like to get up tomorrow and see it said that I suggested the new president go out and play in the traffic. So. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome President Mackey to Michigan State University. On behalf of the legislature, the governor, and I'm sure all of state government, I can say that we are truly pleased to have such an outstanding individual to lead this prestigious university into the next decade. The contributions Michigan State University has made to this state has been numerous and weighty, and I am confident these will continue and grow under President Mackey's leadership. But he, as well as the entire higher education community in this state, understands the challenges ahead. To strike a balance between quality and equality in our educational programs, we must not sacrifice one for the other. To help students as well as the entire community and state receive an education for living as well as educating them to make a living. To provide some constants in our state's values of learning, growing, and exploring, even in arenas that might not be currently popular. And to challenge each of us to create a new kind of state and world to keep pace with the rapid, often abrupt changes that will continue to characterize our world. Finally, to do all of this within the presumed limits of time and resources calls for the leadership of a man such as Dr. Cecil Mackey. And so it is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the state of Michigan and to the presidency of Michigan State University. We in the legislature and state government look forward to working with you for progress in this outstanding institution of higher learning and the great state of Michigan. Welcome, President Mackey.
Thank you, Speaker Krim, for those challenging remarks, not only for Dr. Mackey, but for all of us here at Michigan State University. I was going to say before this snowstorm the following. On the platform this afternoon are four gentlemen whose presence here is in itself a greeting that symbolizes 38 years of dedication to education progress and institutional development. However, one of the four, Dr. Clifton R. Wharton, Jr., the 14th president of the university, is a victim of the snowstorm. Dr. Wharton was of special help to me as chairperson of the board and a member of the search and selection committee in that his duties at SUNY, as president of SUNY, include the filling of over 60 presidencies as vacancies occur. So you can see he had access to names as well as evaluation of persons. Dr. Wharton sent us a telegram, which I will read. Dear President Mackey, the fates and the buffalo snow have conspired to frustrate my attendance at the inaugural ceremony today, but I am with you in spirit. Dolores and I wish you and Mrs. Mackey every success in what we know will be an illustrious presidency in the great Spartan tradition. Sincerely, Clifton R. Wharton, Jr. The remaining three persons need no introduction, but I present them to you at this time. The 12th president of the university, Dr. John A. Hanna. Dr. Hanna was consulted throughout the search process by the search committee and trustees His knowledge of the university and of outstanding nominees throughout the country was extremely helpful. I next present the 13th president of the university, Dr. Walter Adams. And likewise, Walter's advice was always available to us. The next person I would present to you was the 15th president of the university, Dr. Edgar L. Hardin. Without Ed Hardin, the search could not have been successful. Dr. Hardin continued as president to give us adequate time to select a new president. In reviewing the chronology of the search and selection committee, I found these comments. Quote, on October 28, 1977, the MSU Board of Trustees, in unanimous action, appointed Dr. Edgar L. Hardin as acting president beginning January 1, 1978. At a press conference, Dr. Hardin expressed the hope that the interim appointment would be a short one and that it would not be too many months away before he returned to the presidency of Story Oldsmobile. Ed, I think perhaps the trustees misinterpreted the words too many months away. Words obviously cannot express the depth of meaning that the presence of these three gentlemen, the telegram from Dr. Wharton, brings to this ceremony. We are most grateful to them. Sitting directly in front of me and in front of the band are 113 individuals who bring greetings from 113 other colleges and universities, 53 in Michigan and 60 from other states. Many of these individuals have made long trips in order that this afternoon may be more meaningful to all of us. Will each of you who is here as a delegate of another college or university please rise? Thank you. In addition, we have received by mail or messenger official greetings from more than 40 institutions and organizations. These will be on display at the reception later this evening, and they will be on display in Dr. Mackey's office next week. Michigan State University is a land-grant university, a pioneer land-grant university, and a premier land-grant university. Whatever other honors the university may attain, the land-grant philosophy is central to its being. We are honored this afternoon to have as our speaker the president of the National Association of State Universities and Land-Grant Colleges, Dr. Robert L. Clodius. During his illustrious career, Dr. Clodius has served the profession of agricultural economics, the cause of higher education, and the land-grant philosophy in many ways. After completing his baccalaureate degree at the University of California at Berkeley in 1942 and his doctorate at the same institution in 1950, he moved to the University of Wisconsin, where he served for 20 years in a variety of roles, including 2 years as chairman of his department, 7 years as vice president for academic affairs, and 1 year as acting president. During these years, he also served one term as chairman of the Committee on Institutional Cooperation and 6 years as vice president of the Midwest University's Consortium on International Activities. A member of many professional and honorary societies, he has served as an advisor or consultant to the American Council on Education, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Center for Research Libraries. He has guided educational programs in South America, East Africa, Indonesia, Sierra Leone. It is my pleasure to present to you the President of the National Association of State Universities and Land-Grant Colleges, Dr. Robert L. Clodius. Dr. Clodius.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, this is the inauguration of Cecil Mackey as the 16th president of Michigan State University. But it is more than that. It is a celebration, an opportunity to perform publicly with appropriate rites, to honor, to proclaim, and to publish widely. It is also a dedication of a person. This man sets aside his life for a period of time to devote it to the university. In this sense, it is like a marriage. Another person who is marrying the university today is Claire Mackey. And while this is not her celebration, all of us who have been in this business or have observed it for a while must recognize with the greatest respect and admiration the vital role that a wife does play. Now let us examine the tasks, duties, obligations, and responsibilities that President Mackey assumes and the milieu within which he will function. Certain of these are held in common by all presidents, but others are uniquely his and shared only by his predecessors who are here today. To begin with responsibilities broadly shared among presidents, we find academic leadership usually in first place where it properly belongs. But how realistic is this? When we also note that the president is responsible for the business, administrative, and managerial functions as well. He must document in detail procedural compliance with federal and state regulations regarding affirmative action, occupational safety, use of human subjects in research, humane treatment of animals, access for the handicapped, disposal of toxic waste, the right to privacy, the right of public access to information, the right to bargain collectively, and so forth. No one quarrels with the principles involved, although one might be upset at the formulation of the questions, which all seem to be in this following form. Have you stopped beating your wife and children? When did you stop? Can you prove that you have stopped and won't start it again? Parenthetically, I might ask if the University Presidential Search and Selection Advisory Committee received approval from the Committee on Research in Human Subjects when they turned up with Dr. Mackey. If not, who knows? HEW might declare the whole proceedings null and void, and we should go home now. The exercise of academic leadership is complicated further by another feature of campus life that is, I believe, a reflection of widespread American social and political thought and behavior. On campus a decade ago, it was called participatory democracy. Now it is increasingly referred to as single-issue coalition politics. To the university president, it means that everybody wants in his act and help him run the university their way. In former times, the president dealt with only the major identifiable publics of the university: students, the faculty, alumni, and the legislature in the case of a public institution. Now it seems the president must deal with each identifiable subgroup within the student body, within the faculty, within the alumni, the legislature, the public generally. Whereas in the past, he was concerned only with the majority in each group. Thus, it was possible, more than a decade ago, for a university president to say that his primary concerns were football tickets for the alumni, sex for the students, and parking for the faculty. Oh, if life could only be that simple again, the president would have some time left over to devote to academic affairs. As we look at Michigan State University, What are some of the special things for which the president is responsible? It is a remarkable listing and requires a 60-page fact book with entries beginning from Abrams Planetarium and extending to water research. We learn there is an interest and obligation to teach and study the culture of farms and the culture of cities, the health of humans and the health of horses. The university teaches workers how to deal with management and teaches management how to deal with the workers. If these things seem a bit paradoxical, it tells us that the president must deal with many paradoxes. While someone else advertises that they are the nation's largest innkeeper, which may be true, it is true that Michigan State University conducts the nation's largest residence halls program with approximately 20,000 persons in campus housing. But it is not to take note of these responsibilities that brings me here today. It is not the husbandry of fields, of cities, of farmers, or workers, or students, or management that is this president's most awesome responsibility. Rather, it is the husbandry of the democratic ideals that are embodied in the Land Grant Act of 1862. This is a remarkable piece of legislation, enacted as it was in the darkest period of our Civil War. Let me read a bit of it to you, because like classic prose, it is worth hearing many times over. That there be granted to the several states an amount of public land. Each state may take and claim the benefit of this act to the endowment, support, and maintenance of at least one college, where the leading object shall be, without excluding other scientific and classical studies, and including military tactics, to teach such branches of learning as are related to agriculture and the mechanic arts, in such manner as the legislatures of the states may respectively prescribe, in order to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits and professions in life. What makes these ideas so special in this context today at Michigan State University is that this university was the prototype, having been founded in 1855, for all the institutions established later under the Land Grant Act. This university is a pioneering university, a pioneer in the great revolutionary educational philosophy of more than 117 years ago. It is my belief that the revolution has not yet run its course, and that Michigan State University and its sister institutions have a great role to play as continuing leaders in the revolution of what constitutes high quality, high performance public higher education. Americans have a remarkably progressive mentality in dealing with their revolutionary democratic ideals. We remember fondly the Boston Tea Party, the shot heard round the world fired by embattled farmers, and the Declaration of Independence. But how many Americans give significance to the Treaty of Paris in 1783 that formally recognized the United States as a nation? We are motivated and inspired by the values, by the spirit of 1776. It is this same sense of motivation and inspiration that we find today in the Land Grant Act of 1862. Among the many who survived the decade of the 1960s in higher education, and who in a few weeks will survive the decade of the 1970s, inshallah, let us suggest an interpretation of some of the principles to be derived from a legislative act at a time when the Republic was in deep travail. One, in the first instance, we find a willingness to make a leap of faith in education. The Land Grant Act was a social invention. No one knew for sure if it would work or what the consequences might be. I am sure it would not have passed today's tests of ex ante zero-based budgeting, cost-benefit analysis, MBO, and PPBS. although hindsight makes it look very good indeed. Two, we also find a belief in the social value of higher education, that subsidizing public colleges is good for society as a whole, that the consequences of uplifting the industrial classes is good for them and necessary for the good of society. Three, we also find a belief that subsidized public research is desirable because the Act speaks of establishing experimental farms and reporting, quotes, experiments made with their costs and results. And parenthetically, I might say, this sounds like the ancestor of publish or perish, and may well be the ancestor of Regulation A21. That's sort of an inside joke there. Four, with the establishment of the Department of Agriculture, also in 1862, we find the basis for a partnership between an operating arm of the federal government and an operating arm of the state. Five, we find a strong belief in egalitarianism. If one interprets the category of the professional classes as being persons of advantaged backgrounds, then clearly the industrial classes are the disadvantaged, to whom opportunity is offered through the means of federal subsidy. Six, it is also interesting and significant that the subsidy is not given to the student or the family, but to the state legislature, and the legislature in turn to the public institution to hold down costs. Obviously, cost was seen as a barrier for a college education for the industrial classes, and there was to be at least not less than one college where low cost was public policy. Seven, finally we find the phrase, in such manner as the legislatures of the states may respectively prescribe. This has an ominous note until one reads immediately further, in order to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits and professions in life. In this instance, as all academic persons know, the only way to promote such liberal and practical education is by delegating responsibility for curriculum and teaching to the faculty. I am sure all state legislatures and governors understand this. The interesting precedent here is that the federal government sets no role for itself in academic matters. So we are gathered today, standing on the edge of the decade of the 1980s, and by the side of this pioneering university and its 16th president, peering into the uncertain future, and what is to be said. One thing that is clear is that the challenges of public higher education addressed by the Land-Grant Act are still with us. The leap of faith is still there, and people believe in the value of higher education. But we need to reassess the balance between the liberal and practical. Do the younger and older among our students today seek a good education, or are they merely seekers after jobs? The question of balance between education and job and the value of college is also related to the next question about who benefits from higher education. Our forefathers believed there was great public benefit to come from an educated citizenry and from a citizenry with marketable skills, for the things they produce benefit all. Today, there are others who say a college education is like a house. It shelters only those who live inside, and like buying a house, young persons should take out a mortgage to buy their education in the marketplace. Since being in the debtor class is hardly a privilege, would it not continue to be good public policy to help students stay out of debt rather than throwing them into it? In the 1980s, we shall still face the challenge of the disadvantage. Great strides have been made, but there are big gains yet to be made. Matters of access for the young, for the old, for the urban dweller and the rural dweller, for women, for working mothers and working others, for minorities, for the handicapped are all tied up with matters of cost and subsidy and their distribution and control. In 1862, it was taken as a matter of course that these colleges would do research, conduct experiments, and report the results. In the 1980s, we shall continue to work for the support of research from both public and private sources. Research is vital to the university, and it is hard to imagine a good education not based on research and scholarly inquiry. In the 1980s, we shall continue to seek better ways of working with the federal government. State universities were created to serve the public interest. The agencies of the federal government were created to serve the public interest. It seems reasonable that through true partnership and cooperation, the public interest might be jointly served. Certainly, the use of adversarial techniques seems poorly designed to bring the cooperation this country needs between its universities and the departments of housing and urban development, of energy, of agriculture, of state, of interior, of health and welfare, of commerce, and of course the new Department of Education. When this new partnership is seen and new credibility established, perhaps then the president will not be required daily to prove procedural compliance and can again participate in academic affairs. Let me close by giving a small prescription for the faculty and students and administrators of this university. Look up to the stars, for in those vast reaches and infinite mysteries is enough wonder to recommend humility to us all. Look out across your farms and cities and find your people and their problems and respond to them, and to those also who live over the horizon. Look down to your roots, because it is there you find the enduring values of public obligation, public responsibility, and public trust through teaching, research, and service. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Clodius, for those interesting insights into the Office of Presidency of an institution such as Michigan State, as well as your remarks concerning Michigan State University as a land-grant school and the role that lies ahead of us. Before we proceed with the installation of the president, we shall have the privilege of hearing a musical selection presented by the chorale, the State Singers, and the Wind Symphony. The selection they have chosen is Vivace from Gloria by John Rutter. The music will be conducted by Charles Smith. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Smith, members of the chorus, and members of the Wind Symphony. We come now to the ceremony of installation. In order that this ritual may proceed without interruption, I ask that you hold your applause until the installation is completed. Michigan State University is the land-grant university for the state of Michigan, designated in 1863 by the Michigan legislature to be the beneficiary of the endowment provided by the Morrill Act and supplemented by subsequent acts of the Congress of the United States. The Constitution of the State of Michigan declares it to be public policy to encourage forever schools and means of education. The legislature, having the power of appropriation, shares the primary responsibility for implementing this policy. Please note, Bobby. The Constitution confers upon the Board of Trustees the freedom, power, and responsibility to develop a free and distinguished university and to promote the welfare of mankind through teaching, research, and public service. The Board of Trustees, elected by the voters of the state and responsible to all of the people of the state, exercises the final authority in the government of the university within limits fixed by the state constitution. I now ask the members of the Board of Trustees to rise as I call their names and to remain standing for the installation of the president. Trustee Raymond Krolikowski, Trustee Carol Lick, Trustee Aubrey Radcliffe, Trustee Barbara Sawyer, Trustee Michael Smidra, Trustee Jack Stack, I believe Trustee Blanche Martin is not here. Cecil Mackey, will you please come forward to the designated spot? And will Claire Mackey, who has been a member of the chorus, please come to the platform. The Board of Trustees, in exercising its rights, delegates to the President of the University and through the President to the faculty appropriate authority and responsibility over matters for which they are held accountable by the Board. These matters include educational policy and the development of a strong and efficient organization within which to accomplish the objectives of the university. The President, as the principal executive officer of the university, exercises such powers as are inherent in the position in promoting, supporting, or protecting the interests of the university and managing and directing all of its affairs. On June 7, 1979, the Board of Trustees elected you, Cecil Mackey, to be the 16th president of this university. In accepting this office, you have agreed to discharge your responsibilities faithfully and to the best of your ability. Now, therefore, by authority of the State of Michigan, vested in the Board of Trustees, I declare you installed as the president of Michigan State University with all the rights, privileges, and responsibilities of that office. Cecil and Claire Mackey, I speak for the Board of Trustees and the citizens we represent in welcoming you to Michigan and to Michigan State University. As a token of that welcome, I present to you, Cecil Mackey, this certificate printed in commemoration of your installation as president of this university. And to you, Claire Mackey, I present the University Medallion given in recognition of your position as the First Lady of the University.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the board, Dr. Clodius, Speaker Krim, faculty, students, ladies and gentlemen, this is indeed an honor for me, a pleasure for my family as well. Mr. Speaker, I suspect the press somewhere may interpret your remarks as indicating Krim finds new running mate. While it would not be in your tradition, the subline might read, outcome of race uncertain. Dr. Hanna, Dr. Adams, Dr. Hardin, your presence here is something special. I appreciate very much your being on the platform. Your being here reminds me of a remark Will Rogers once made. He said, "A man who's held a bull by the tail knows five or six things more than one who hasn't." I look forward to learning those five or six things from each of you. I'd also like to extend a special welcome and extend my appreciation to two other people in the audience. Dr. Larry Graves, the acting president of Texas Tech. Dr. Carl Riggs, the academic vice president of the University of South Florida. Both individuals from institutions where I have served, I've enjoyed working with them and appreciate their coming today. And finally, my appreciation to my mother and my two children who are here today, Ann and John, who had their piano lessons rearranged so they could make it. They considered themselves the losers in that bargain. In a world where many have come to believe that violence is the only way to get attention, and that force is the only way to persuade, those institutions that train the intellect, that humanize the spirit, and seek the truth unendingly, take on their greatest value. Thomas Jefferson, in the early days of our republic, observed, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be." It was his hope and that of his colleagues that the experiment they were entering upon would establish the fact that people could be governed by reason and truth. Mr. Jefferson understood well that an educated citizenry was essential to the success of the great venture that he helped initiate. The value of education and the vital link between education and freedom have never been more apparent than they are today. In these days of crisis and anxiety, as our complex society confronts an uncertain future, it is abundantly clear that there is no stronger force for reason, no more important avenue to truth, no surer hope for human dignity than our universities. The role they play is unique. This would not have surprised Mr. Jefferson, for in addition to his many other uncommon talents, he also possessed an uncommon understanding of the nature of the university. Michigan State University has a long history and a proud tradition of quality and service. Its constitutional status attests to the high priority given education by the citizens of this state and by their elected officials. Its role as a pioneer land-grant institution has kept it in the forefront of progress, fostering change and exercising leadership. Its faculty have brought it recognition as one of the world's great centers of teaching and research. Through a century and a quarter, it has grown in depth and breadth, matured and prospered, increased in stature, while never losing touch with the people it was created to serve. In the truest sense, Michigan State University has lived up to the responsibility that Lyndon Johnson saw for this country when he said, "We must open the doors of opportunity, but we must also equip our people to walk through those doors." I urge all of you, as faculty, as students, as alumni, as trustees, as citizens, and as friends, to join me in a commitment to excellence and in a reaffirmation of the faith that has made Michigan State the great university that it is. Thank you very much.
Before we rise for the benediction, let me make two announcements. First, those of you who have been invited to the reception and who need transportation to the Kellogg Center will find buses waiting at the west exit after the reception. Second, we request that all of you, except the platform party, be seated after the benediction and that our guests remain seated until after the academic reception, which is an integral part of the program. Please rise for the benediction by the chorus.